From the National Catholic Register, this is Register Radio, bringing light and clarity to the news and topics that affect your life.
The assassination of conservative leader and cultural icon Charlie Kirk continues to cause shockwaves across the country. This week on Register Radio, we look at his immense and enduring legacy on college campuses when we talk with the several individuals who are on the forefront of where Catholic universities and colleges are, especially as they relate to the influence of Charlie Kirk. We're joined by Catholic journalist Jack Figg, who has a new piece for the Register on Charlie Kirk, and Hillsdale College journalism student Moira Gleason. And then, Salon Tadia, Europe correspondent for the Register, tells us about Dubai's hidden faith, how the city's Catholic community thrives, and she also tells us the incredible story of Joan of Arc's ring. Hello, I'm Matthew Bunsen, host of Register Radio and EWTN News' Vice President and Editorial Director. I'm here in our Washington, D.C. studios, as always, with Shannon Mullen, Editor-in-Chief of the National Catholic Register. Hello, Shannon.
Hello, Matthew.
Well, as we have seen since the murder, the assassination of Charlie Kirk, the country continues to mourn him in so many different ways, but there's also a lot of controversy surrounding the reactions to his death. But it's also worth asking about his legacy on college campuses. How did he manage to reach an entire generation of college students, and where does his massive movement go from here? As I just mentioned, we're joined by Catholic journalist Jack Figg and also Hillsdale College journalism student Moira Gleason. Welcome both of you to Register Radio.
Thanks so much, Matthew. It's exciting to be here.
Thank you very much.
Well, Jack, let's start with you. What was your obvious initial reaction to the horrifying news of Charlie Kirk's assassination?
Yeah, I mean, it sent shockwaves through the entire campus. So I'm out at Benedictine College, and it was immediate. I was sitting on my front porch with some friends when it happened, and we all were just shocked when the news started pouring in that he had been shot and then that he died. And I walked onto campus to our college coffee shop, and probably an hour after his death, and there was just kind of this somber undertone in the coffee shop and then throughout campus for the entire next day or two. And I was talking with a friend about it, who he was just very perturbed by the assassination. And he noted, he was like, yeah, this is the first time that I've gone to confession in a while. And I was like, why? And he just said, you know, it really just kind of reminded me of my own mortality. And I needed somebody to talk to, and I wanted to talk to a priest. And so I just went to confession. And I started prodding a little bit more. And I was like, what was it about Charlie Kirk that kind of made you have such a strong reaction to death? And he just said, he was kind of a stable force in my life. He was so inspiring. He was so raw and vulnerable in his commentary. And he really helped me understand the world and kind of have this desire to pursue the truth and to pursue my faith. And that sentiment resonated with so many other college students that I spoke to. They all commented on how they just admired Charlie for his love of the faith, for his love of Jesus, and for his love of the truth, and for the way that he just spoke so in such a raw fashion and in such an honest, and how he was so kind and compassionate when presenting that message. And so he just wanted to get to the truth and wanted that truth to be known by everybody.
Yeah, Jack's piece, which is up on ncregister.com now, really captures this, just the sense of just being stunned by the news and how people are processing that, you know, now a week later. Moira is working on a piece specific to her college, Hillsdale in Michigan. Moira, what's the connection between Hillsdale and Charlie Kirk?
So our president at Hillsdale, Dr. Larry Arn, has been friends with Charlie Kirk for more than a decade, back to when he was just starting Turning Point USA. So there's a longstanding relationship between Charlie Kirk and the college, not really in any official capacity, except that the college and Kirk's platform agreed on a lot of issues in education in particular. So it's been just like a very kind of fruitful partnership. They've worked on, Charlie Kirk spoke at a leadership conference that Hillsdale hosted this year in February and has just been involved in our online courses, a lot of different content that our college puts out. And yeah, so I think that made it very personal for a lot of people on Hillsdale's campus. The first reaction, I was very impressed. The first reaction was prayer. Charlie, we got the news that he had passed away around maybe 5 or 6 p.m. I don't remember, but at 8 p.m., we had the students had organized a prayer vigil in our chapel, and it was packed. There were hundreds of students. I saw faculty and staff also attended, and just everyone praying together and singing hymns together in this moment of mourning, but also it's just prayer for our country. And I thought it was really beautiful that that was the response. It wasn't anger, even though this was obviously a national crisis, but also very personal for a lot of people. But the first response was to turn to prayer.
Moira, Hillsdale in particular has a reputation for just being focused on civil discourse and a search for the truth. So was that what resonated so much with students there?
I think so. I think we really strive for conversation, and we believe in having, like, the best way to learn and to pursue the truth is to have open dialogue. And you don't always have to be right, but it's kind of a shared pursuit. And that's really what Kirk was trying to do on college campuses, facilitate this shared discourse and give people who maybe felt like they couldn't speak what they actually believed the chance to be seen and to find community, but also just to meet others with respect and learn how to engage with people that they disagree with respect for this. And that's what he was doing on college campuses. That's what we try to do at Hillsdale. And so I think he's really an emblem of that. And that's very scary for people here and for college students who want to be able to pursue the truth in that way, to see that, to see Charlie Kirk killed for living the kind of life that they want to live.
Yeah, and this is for both of you, Jack and Moira. Where do we go from here in terms of advancing the legacy of Charlie Kirk, especially of dialogue and conversation publicly? And I know that Turning Point USA has received applications for, what, almost 4,000 new groups and other things. But from your standpoint, what needs to happen now?
Yeah, I think it's having, encouraging this approach to the dialogue that doesn't come from a place of anger or from hatred, but from this place of desiring to understand the other's point of view and this desire to proclaim the truth. And as Catholics especially, I think that that desire must come from this this love of Jesus Christ and this love for the faith. And I think as young Catholics, we should look to Charlie Kirk as an example for how to evangelize the gospel. He did such a good job of eloquently advancing conservative talking points and for making those approachable to young people, and particularly college students who are just immersed in this very confusing culture that is ideologically driven. And so the thing that I keep thinking about is, How do we as Catholics kind of take Charlie's approach and use that in promoting the faith? And I think that if we take his approach of just wanting to have open and honest dialogue and not be afraid of what other people might say to us and be afraid of how that message will be received, but just be focused on proclaiming the truth, be focused on proclaiming Jesus Christ, and be focused on proclaiming how the Lord has transformed our own lives. And we really start to implement that and have these conversations on college campuses with friends, with peers, with those that disagree with us. I think that could be transforming, I think.
Moira, what would you say?
Yeah, absolutely. I think the most important thing initially is to mourn the person. And I think that's something that maybe it's worth pausing and just recognizing that, like, Kirk represented a lot more than, or he was kind of larger than life. He represented a lot for people, but also, like, there's a family who's grieving, and people have lost a friend. And so it's worth just mourning the life that was lost. But as far as the kind of work that Kirk was trying to do, I think this can be a wake-up call, that just how important civil discourse is, and the way in which he practiced it with respect towards people, and in a willingness to engage just very respectfully, very graciously in open dialogue. I think we've seen from the reaction of a lot of college students across the country just how bad things are, that people are celebrating someone who was killed for promoting dialogue. But that should be a wake-up call that, like, no, we actually need to encourage this more, and not to respond to violence with violence, but to respond with prayer and with a recommitment to open dialogue and to encountering each other in conversation.
Well, thank you both for your work. Thank you both also for continuing that legacy of dialogue, which we need to have now, not just in culture, but especially on college campuses. Shannon, again, where can people find their pieces?
Yes, they're going to be, you can find them at ncregister.com. They're also going to be featured in our upcoming print issue, which is Lands On or About, October the 5th. So there's a number of other pieces related to the Charlie Kirk aftermath that are in the pipeline.
Yeah, a lot to discuss, a lot to assess, and a lot to cherish. Well, thank you both so much, and look forward to having you on again at some point on Register Radio.
It's my pleasure. Thank you so much for having us.
Well, you're listening to Register Radio on EWTN Radio. When we come back, we talk with Solène Tadier about Dubai's hidden faith, how the city's Catholic community is thriving. Stay tuned to Register Radio here on EWTN Radio.
Let's return to Register Radio on EWTN.
And welcome back. I'm Matthew Bunsen in studio here in D.C. with Shannon Mullen, editor-in-chief of the National Catholic Register. Well, the city of Dubai, part of the United Arab Emirates, is famous for its climate of religious tolerance, even as it is home to a thriving Christian community. But how real is that religious tolerance, and what limitations do Catholics face? We're joined by Solène Tadier, Register Europe correspondent, who has documented the situation in her new article, Dubai's Hidden Faith, How the City's Catholic Community Thrives. And she joins us right now from Armenia. So, Solène, welcome.
Thank you very much for having me.
Well, before we get to any discussion about Dubai or the Ring of Joan of Arc, I know that you just attended a rally in honor of Charlie Kirk. Here we are in having our conversation on this episode about the impact of Charlie Kirk. Certainly, this is a demonstration of his global reach, isn't it?
Yes, I was really impressed, actually. I did not expect that. Like, when I arrived, I was brought by some Christian friends here in town to this big rally. It was a full house. It was in a concert hall. And you had people, like, mostly Armenians, but even local expats. And there was some traditional Armenian music and people bearing witness to how Charlie Kirk was instrumental in their personal path of faith and political vision. It was very moving, and yeah, it makes you realize that there are some stakes, like global stakes, that can really unite people all around the world, not only Christians, but people who are attached to a traditional vision of the world, and that's something very interesting.
Solène, you've been traveling quite a bit. So Dubai, I know you've been back in France over the summer. But let's talk about that piece that's available at ncregister.com, Dubai's Hidden Faith, How the City's Catholic Community Thrives. It opens with this wonderful picture that you took of a Our Lady of Lourdes grotto, and in the background is this. You see the minarets of Dubai. So it's a very arresting image, and it's just surprising what you experienced there. Tell us, just paint us a little bit of a picture of your first impressions when you visited.
Yes, first of all, I did not expect to see so many people. Like, it was overwhelming. I got there probably 15 minutes in advance for mass, but it was already completely impossible to even approach the gates of the church to attend mass. Like, you have like literally dozens of thousands of people for each service. So I had to attend mass from the courtyard. But I was impressed by the like how fervent people were, people from so many different countries. And there are so many people that they have to arrange services, masses in so many languages on Saturday and Sunday. Like I said in my piece, the local priest told me that sometimes they have to distribute some 200,000 hosts communion during the weekend, which is unbelievable. So it's called not for nothing one of the busiest parish church in the world, because it's called the Saint Mary's in Oud Meta, there in Dubai. So I was so struck by this vitality, and at the same time, mirroring that, you have to be very discreet in the way you display your faith. So as you can see in the first picture, opening my piece on the register, you have the grotto, a beautiful grotto, but it can't be seen from the streets on purpose in order not to attract anybody to a Christian faith. So you can't display any cross on top of the church. And the grotto turns its back to the street, so people can worship the Virgin Mary, they can attend mass and everything, but in a secret way, in a discreet way. And that's what struck me. It's like while attending mass from the courtyard, there was this huge muezzin, like the call to prayer, right behind my back, that was completely drowning the sound of the gospel of the day. So it was a bit troubling, I must say, for a Catholic that used to live in Rome, you know, like a very strong Latin Catholic, used to be overwhelmed, like surrounded by a very strong Catholic identity. It was a weird sensation, but very interesting one.
So who are the Catholics who are attending these masses?
So depending on the when you're going during the day, because you have masses in Konkani, sometimes like every possible languages, so you have a lot of people from India, Pakistan, you know, the local migrants who are there to be the workforce, and you have some more upper class expats, like you have a lot of French Catholics, for instance, Italians, people from the US, so very, very various crowd. So depending on when you're going, so when I went, it turned out that I had no idea, but it was an English service, but attended by thousands and thousands and thousands of people coming from India that day. So I had no idea where I was. Basically, it was a very, very interesting experience, like a very strong cosmopolitan experience. But I spoke to some people from the French parish, and they told me that they're French speaking, not only from France, but from Canada, from Switzerland, from Lebanon. It's a super strong community, and it has grown by over 25% in just 5 years, which is quite interesting and important. And the same can be said from about different communities there.
Yes, I am so fascinated by it. I do want to get to Joan of Arc. So Len and I have been talking just amongst ourselves, because this summer I've been reading Mark Twain's biography, historical fiction on Joan of Arc, which is I can highly recommend. But let's talk about Joan of Arc's ring. This, as you say in your piece for the Register, this is her only existing relic. What do we know about this ring?
So yes, it was the ring that belonged to her, and that was taken from her in the context, like by the English during her execution in the Hundred Years' War context. and that was an asset of war. So that was taken by England after Joan of Arc died, and so it was kept there for so long. So it's still the guilt devotional ring, and so the inscription is for like Jesus and Mary, and so it represents like it's like IHS and Mar for Jesus and Mary, and so it was kept there in England for all these centuries, and so many people in France, including the one who purchased the ring, had no idea that this ring even existed, and they found out about its existence in 2016, literally 2 days before it was sold, like before the auction happened. And so basically, so that's the president of Le Puy du Fou. I was there in August and I had a great conversation with him, Nicolas de Villiers, and he told me himself, like, I had no idea this ring existed. And one day I received a phone call from a friend telling me, oh, it's going to be sold in an auction like in 2 days from now. And like literally in 48 hours, he was able to raise 400,000 euros in France.
Well, that itself strikes me as something of a miracle.
Like the craziest thing is that after, like, they won the auction, and after with the added taxes, it was precisely 400,000 pounds, the exact sum that was gathered in France. Like, if it's not providence, I just don't know what it is. I mean, that's so funny. It's incredible. Even people giving 5 euros, 10 euros, people giving more money in 24 hours, like, spreading the word, people like saying, oh, I promise you, I'm going to give you 400 and several thousands. And just two days, they were able to accomplish that miracle. It really seems like Joan of Arc wanted her ring back in France.
We're not even doing complete justice to the story. There's so many aspects to it, but Scotland Yard plays a role in this. Explain.
Sorry, can you say that again?
Your story talks about a car chase and Scotland Yard. How does that figure into the story?
Oh yes, because basically, since it was a war asset in England, it was out of the question for the English authority to let it out of the country. And so there was a big legal case that happened after, in the aftermath of the purchase, because Nicolas de Villiers told me that he received a warning from the auction sale that it was absolutely impossible. You know, the National Arts Council said, oh no, I mean, the ring cannot be taken out of the territory by law. It's like it's a war treasure. So we don't, and so they forced the auction room to reveal the name of the buyer, and so that's when the scandal happened, and so what de Villiers did, Nicolas de Villiers said, you know, after the auction, I just went there and said, no, I'm not going to take it out of the country. I just want to just take it to different location for a photo shoot. And so they made that happen. They could get permission to take the ring out of the auction room just for a few hours. But they were escorted by bodyguards that had the clear order not to let them out of the country in any way. So they did the photo shoot, and then they were like, oh, they pretended like they completely accepted the rules, and they just took the ring at some point and discreetly took it to the car and said, oh, see you at the auction room. And then they just started driving, and they lost the car with the bodyguards in the streets of London. That's literally that sounds like a modern day novel, or, you know, an action
espionage
movie.
Indeed.
Exactly. Yeah. So they left the country, and then like it became a huge national scandal. The English National Arts Council called them every day asking them to where the ring was, and to they wanted them to give the ring back. So they even sent the police to Le Puy du Fou, asking them to hand over the ring. And Nicolas de Villiers pretended that he lost it. He had lost it. He said, "I'm sorry, I just don't have it. I lost it. I mean, maybe it was lost during the photo shoot or something."
Well, I know we don't want to give away too much, especially we want everyone to read your article, especially the involvement of Queen Elizabeth. It's a great story. And I know, Solène, that again, we're trying to do as much justice as we can, but you can find Joan of Arc's Ring, A Modern Day Heist Return, The Saint's Last Relic to France. Solène, thank you so much as always.
Thank you very much for having me. It's always a pleasure.
Well, that's it for Register Radio this week. Remember, for more news, analysis, and commentary, check out the National Catholic Register online at ncregister.com. Thanks so much for joining us here on Register Radio, here on EWTN. Until next week, on behalf of our producer, Michael McCall, and Shannon Mullen, editor-in-chief of the National Catholic Register, I'm Matthew Bunsen. Please, take care, and God bless.